Supreme Court Justice Patrick Crooks was first elected to the state's highest bench in 1996. He was reelected in 2006. He'll have to make a decision here pretty soon about whether to seek reelection. And he's joined us for a Newsmakers interview. Thank you, Your Honor, for coming in.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me.
I am, this was what, your 20th term on the bench?
It's my, 19th? Just finished my 19th
just
year.
Just finished your 19th. Yep. I gave you one too many. I'm sorry. I'll
That's
take
okay.
it back. Well, let me ask you, was this your most difficult term with all that went on, Your Honor? It just ended yesterday.
It's been a difficult term because of the transitions that have occurred.
Okay. In the Abramson lawsuit, which we'll discuss in a minute, in your May filing, you cited uncertainty and turmoil on the court. Can you elaborate on that, please, Your Honor?
Well, we ended up with a situation where we didn't have a procedure in place for electing a Chief Justice after the Government Accountability Board had certified mm-hmm. the election results.
Right.
And so things went in a rather chaotic fashion. Some people voted. They voted by email. I had tried to find out if there was some procedure that we might utilize from some other state that also elects their Chief Justice. And I've got a friend on the Oregon Supreme Court. I went to him and said, what do you guys do? What's your procedure? Excuse me. They basically said, we don't have any. It's an informal kind of a thing. Well, I had hoped that they'd give us some real guidance. They didn't. And I think the way things worked out, it was chaotic. It was chaotic in the sense we had no procedure in place. Mike Gabelman had made a motion, but it had never been voted on. Mm-hmm. And so we started out with some real chaos, I thought.
The Republican legislators who sponsored the constitutional amendment, and Wisconsin, I covered the public hearings on that and the debate, of course, they insisted that this was not aimed at former Chief Justice Shirley Abramson. Was it aimed at her, Your Honor?
I think by some people it was. By others, I think there was a feeling that this was the right way to go in the long run. There are 22 other states that elect their own Chief Justice, that the justices elect the Chief Justice. And I, to be honest about it, I wasn't aiming this at Shirley. My feeling about it was, in the long run, this court would be much better off if we elected our own chief, that people would be nicer to each other, mm-hmm. they would be more polite to each other, everybody would hope that in turn they would get their chance to be the chief.
Yes.
And that's the way it's worked in the other states that elect their own Chief Justice.
So you actually, as one voter, voted for the constitutional change?
I did.
You did, for just those reasons?
Yes.
And then it was certified, and then came an email. Was the motion offered by email by Justice Gabelman?
Actually, it was offered in conference. We never voted on it. And then he repeated it, if I remember correctly, by email.
Okay. And you weren't comfortable with this from a procedural standpoint, Your Honor?
I was not. I thought that we should have agreed in advance of the procedure. I would have preferred that we did our election of a new Chief Justice in public.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that the public ought to be able to see the process. Of course, that never happened. We had some other complications that caused only four of the seven of us to vote.
So there were only four, but that constituted the enough to seat Chief Justice Pat Rogenczak.
Yes, it did.
Do you, let me ask you this. Did former Chief Justice Abramson come to you and seek your advice on whether to file a federal court lawsuit, Your Honor?
No, she did not.
She did not. Had she come to you, would you have advised her, maybe you ought to rethink that?
I think I would have suggested to her that she go very slowly in regard to whether or not to file an action. I can understand why she did it. I think that there are, as Judge Peterson suggested, some plausible arguments in her favor.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some public relations aspects to all of this and some transition aspects that would have caused me to suggest to her that she move very slowly.
You mentioned the word transition. You also cited that in your May pleadings in Justice Abramson's lawsuit. What would have been a more transition? What would have been a transition plan, Your Honor?
Well, there were a number of things that had been talked about. Just as an example, Justice David Prosser had suggested that there be no change to another Chief Justice until about the 1st of August, when the new term technically would start.
Yes.
There were others that suggested at least we ought to finish this term, which ended actually yesterday.
Yesterday, June 30th.
That's right. And I think if all of us had agreed on a starting date, if all of us had agreed on a procedure to elect the new Chief Justice, things would have been much smoother.
So you, I just want to be clear. You and Justice Ann Walsh Bradley and Justice Shirley Abramson have never voted officially on the motion to seat Chief Justice Rogozniak as the chief, Your Honor?
That's correct.
That's okay. Well, talk about how would you characterize your relationship with the current Chief Justice?
Oh, I think it's a good one. We've known each other a long time. If we go back far enough, Pat Rogozniak and I and Ann Bradley and a couple others were all running at the same time in 1995 for the court. So I've known Pat Rogozniak since that time. When she ran for the Court of Appeals, I supported her. I actually asked some supporters of mine to get in line to be helpful for her. I think over the years we've had a pretty decent relationship.
You followed all the pleadings in her federal lawsuit. You've read them all and you've submitted your own brief. Do you think Chief Justice, is there a question in your mind whether Chief Justice Rogozniak is legally the Chief Justice right now, or has that been resolved, sir?
No, it really has not been resolved. Judge Peterson, who's a district court judge in the Western District of Wisconsin here in Madison, has that case in front of him. He's indicated he hoped he would make a ruling by the 1st of August. It would not surprise me if whatever he did was appealed to the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. There have been some procedural things that have been already appealed to the Seventh Circuit. So I think it's still very much in flux.
Well, but he has also declined to issue, he has refused to enjoin and hold the process in abeyance while he issues the final ruling. So in essence, he's more or less gone along with Chief Justice Rogozniak as the chief. Correct ruling? Is that a correct interpretation?
Yes, it is a correct interpretation. I think what he said is that he didn't want to interfere with the process in the meantime. Excuse me. I had hoped that he might use what I called his equitable powers to set forth a transition plan. This is way back in the beginning when all of this was occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And I had hoped that he would do that to sort of ease the kind of what I saw as chaos that was existing initially. He refused to do that, and I can understand that too. He felt that we should work it out ourselves, if you will.
Was there still chaos when the court adjourned its term yesterday, sir?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Did you hold yourself out or hope at some point to be the interim Chief Justice while this matter was resolved?
Yes.
Would that have been for a year or two, or well, your potential term is up next year.
It would have been for a period of time where I felt I could help both sides. I've always been sort of, over the last several years, a bridge between both sides on our court. And the reason that I did that was because I thought that I might be a peacemaker, that I might be able to resolve things by being able to go back and forth and talk to both sides, mm-hmm. as I've always been able to do.
Had you been Chief Justice, how would you try to be a peacemaker or try to get a more collegial court, which you must admit it's been pretty tough. It's been non-collegial in some of the recent years, Your Honor. So what steps would you have taken to try to bring people together?
Well, let me start out this way, if I might. I think we have a very talented court. I think that we're very fortunate, despite some of the publicity to the contrary, in that we have seven people who are bright, who are hardworking, who care about doing a good job. And I would have tried to utilize those talents and abilities. Just to give you some examples, Steve, one of the problems we've had is in regard to a perception out there that our court is not nonpartisan, that our court is not independent. And I would have tried to urge my colleagues, whenever they had a chance to speak, whenever they had a chance to meet with members of the public, to emphasize that we do have a nonpartisan court, an independent court, a court that makes decisions based on the law. I think that would have been helpful. One of the other problems, and I don't know if you've had the chance to read the long article in the New Yorker magazine about our court.
I have not.
It was entitled, and I'm paraphrasing a bit, something along the lines of the destruction of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And one of the things that the article aimed at was the fact that we have a problem with our recusal rules, mm-hmm. and talked about the fact that that was sort of the beginning of the divisions on our court. I would have tried to urge my fellow justices to do something about that. We have a, excuse me, we have a sort of a strange situation in that we have a subjective rule in regard to the statutes, in regard to recusal. We have an objective rule in regard to our judicial code. However, the results of violation of either the objective rule or the subjective rule are different. And we're out of line with 48 of the 50 states and the feds. The federal government and 48 of the states have an objective rule. And that would be a step in the right direction for us, in my opinion, in terms of healing the perception that's out there in regard to our court and the divisions on our court.
What is there about the personal and professional styles of both Chief Justice Rogan Zak and former Chief Justice Shirley Abramson that has had them at loggerheads often, Your Honor?
They're both very strong personalities. And I say this recognizing that not everybody is right all of the time, but I think both of them feel generally that they're right when they take a position. And oftentimes those positions are contrary one to the other. And so that has caused some difficulties between the two of them, which is unfortunate because if you pull back from the court and just talk about them as individuals, they're both nice people. They're both very bright. They both work hard. They both care about the court.
Well, In hindsight, did former Chief Justice Shirley Abramson not share enough collectively in terms of powers? Did she assume too much authority, Your Honor, and that's been a cause of the friction?
Let me answer it this way. As any person, she's evolved through the years as the Chief Justice. When she first became the Chief, and this is just my view now, I think she was very unsure of herself. I think she felt she had to grab her authority and stamp it clearly so that everybody saw that she was in charge. Mm-hmm. Through the years, I thought that she had evolved and was much more open with her discussions with the other members of the court, had frankly become a much better Chief Justice than she was in the beginning.
Okay. So she was sharing more power with other justices in recent years as compared to when she became Chief, and I think it was 96, that's the year that you joined the bench?
I think that's true, and I think she was sharing much more information as well with other members of the court.
Well, look back over the last 5 years. When did you begin to sense, or was there one incident that you began to say, these personal disagreements are increasing and troubling? Can you talk about how you watched that grow over the last 5 years, Your Honor?
Well, I know that you're aware of the fact, and a lot of people are, that there was a physical altercation between Justice Ann Walsh Bradley and Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser has never denied the fact that he ended up, however it occurred, with his hands around Ann Bradley's neck. Mm-hmm. And other people who were there at the time had different versions of what had occurred. That certainly added to difficulties with the court. You may or may not know, I was fortunate in that I wasn't there.
You were not there.
I had just gotten a new pair of contact lenses, and the doctor had told me, don't wear them more than, I think it was 10 hours. I had reached the 10 hours, and I told everybody, I'm going home. Mm-hmm. And so literally, I was home when this happened.
Which led to the filing of an ethics complaint against Justice Prosser, which members of the court have stepped away from, which means it cannot be resolved. What's your idea on how to resolve any complaint against any sitting Supreme Court justice if there's not enough fellow justices to decide the complaint, Your Honor?
Well, I think that, frankly, it would take probably a constitutional amendment to develop a procedure in regard to that type of situation. There are only two of us that have said that we could sit and make a judgment, or at least have not taken ourselves off of the Bradley-Prosser situation. I'm one of them because I wasn't there.
Right.
And I felt I could be fair to both sides. Justice Abramson has not acted one way or the other. But as you know, you need more than two people.
Yes.
To make a decision.
Is it unfortunate that this complaint goes unresolved? And do you still think there's a professional cloud over Justice Prosser because it hasn't been resolved, Your Honor?
I think it's unfortunate that it hasn't been resolved. I think for Justice Prosser, it's been tough. And for Justice Ann Walsh Bradley as well, that this is still hanging out there after all of these years. I don't know if the Judicial Commission ultimately will decide that they should dismiss the matter or how they should dispose of it, but I think it is unfortunate that it's still there. When I watch the interplay between the two of them, for instance, in the conference room, they get along quite well. A lot of years have gone by. The incident really, I think, has faded for both of them, except it's lurking in the background.
Well, under the constitutional amendment that you mentioned, would this allow other justices to come in and resolve complaints like this, or would it allow other retired justices to come in and serve on the Supreme Court for a specific case?
It could allow either. Certainly there's the possibility that the resolution might be using Court of Appeals judges. The resolution might be using former justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But that would really be a call of the legislature initially, and then ultimately the people in amending the Constitution.
Has Chief Justice Rogozin-Zak made some mistakes Chief Justice? Did I read in a news story that, and correct me if this is wrong, that you were quoted as saying she had threatened to take cases away from justices? If I'm far wrong, correct me, sir.
Well, what, excuse me again, what had occurred was that Chief Justice Rogozin-Zak scheduled some conferences, closed conferences, that were not on the court's calendar. We adopt the calendar a year in advance. And under our rules, both our internal operating procedures and our procedural rules, basically the understanding is that there will be no change of the calendar without unanimous consent. Chief Justice Rogozin-Zak had scheduled some of these closed conferences. She didn't have unanimous consent, and so there was serious question as to whether or not it was appropriate to move in that fashion. In one instance, I think she had indicated that if some of us didn't attend and didn't participate, that she would indicate to others that we had withdrawn from participation. She would have no power to do that. I think that was a mistake on her part. I think she's learned from that mistake, and I think we've all moved on.
You've been characterized at times as part of the moderate or liberal wing with Justices Ann Walsh Bradley and former Chief Justice Shirley. Is that a fair characterization, sir?
It depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about a judicial philosophy, it's not a fair characterization. I think that anybody who has watched 19 years of decisions by myself would have to come to the conclusion that I'm a judicial conservative. If you talk about politics, if you talk about are you a political conservative, I don't think I am. I think I'm basically a moderate, and I always have been. When I was in private practice, I was active as a Republican. However, I certainly was not a conservative Republican. I think I was a moderate. And so politically, I think I'm a moderate. But judicially, I think I'm clearly a judicial conservative.
What are your thoughts on how running for the Supreme Court has changed from your 1996 and 2006 races, specifically the influence of third-party groups that would spend millions to help or hurt specific candidates for the court, Your Honor?
Well, it's changed a lot. In 1996, when I was elected to the court, there were seven of us in a primary. And it was a very collegial group, literally. We all got along well. We discussed issues. There was not a lot of money spent. I was fortunate enough to come out first in the primary and then to defeat a very good judge who's recently left us, recently died, Ralph Adam Fine, in the general election. We didn't have to spend a lot of money. There was some dollars that were there in terms of public financing. You're testing my recollection a little bit, but I think that Ralph Fine and I split like $30,000.
Yeah. From it the public financing grant.
Yes.
Yes.
It wasn't much. And in 2006, when I ran for re-election, I was very, very fortunate. I had no opponent. Frankly, that's the last Supreme Court contested race where there's been no opponent. It wasn't a contested race. I was fortunate enough not to have opposition. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have to spend any money other than I think we threw a pizza party at one of the Madison establishments to celebrate the fact that we had no opposition. But that's it. Since then, there's been huge amounts of money.
I know. Are you concerned about that trend, Your Honor?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why? Because special interest groups, it's been said, this isn't my assertion, but you've heard it said that they're buying justice. Is that an overstatement, sir? When special interest groups spend $1, $2, $3 million?
I think it's a legitimate concern. I really do. If you've got an outside group spending, as an example, $2, $3 million in support of a candidate, I think the public becomes somewhat cynical in terms of how this is all going to shake down. Are you going to owe that outside group and the positions of that outside group some real heed when you sit down to vote on a case?
Well, within the last 2 years, you've heard the debate in light of the huge spending. Let's not elect judges, let's appoint judges. Your position on that, Your Honor?
Well, I went back and looked at the debates that occurred when we adopted our Constitution in 1848. And we had the same kind of discussion then, believe it or not, that has occurred recently. The Constitutional Convention opted for elected judges. And we've had that tradition in Wisconsin ever since. I think it would be extremely difficult to change that to an appointed type of situation. I'll just tell you my own experience. I had the experience several times of being considered for the federal bench. In at least two of those times, I was clearly number one with the Judicial Selection Committee. I was not selected. And the reason I wasn't selected was because the decision ultimately is made based on politics. And that's understandable. So anybody who thinks that an appointed system eliminates politics from the process doesn't understand the way it really works.
You've been a part of the institution, and a institution that you care deeply about for 19 years. What toll has the last 5 or 6 years taken on you personally, given the disagreements on the bench, Your Honor?
It's taken a toll physically. It's taken a toll emotionally. I think I started out earlier indicating that we've got very good people on the court. To be honest, I like all of them. I consider all six of them to be my friends. And it's very difficult when you see friends not getting along mm-hmm. with each other. Mm-hmm. So it has been difficult for me. And I know that I should be mature enough at this point to handle the situation. But sometimes you come home in the evening and it's difficult. I share with my wife, it wasn't a good day at the court. But I think we're heading in the right direction. I think that if we can get over the perceptions out there of a partisan court, if we can get over the perceptions that we're not an independent court, if we can make some changes in regard to the recusal rules so that we end up aligned with 48 of the 50 states and the feds in terms of an objective standard, I think we can really make some progress for the future.
Do you want to take advantage of this Wisconsin I interview to announce whether you're going to seek re-election, Your Honor?
No, I'm not ready to do that.
What are going to be the factors in your decision, and when do you hope to make a decision, sir?
I'm hoping to make a decision, certainly, if not late summer, early in the fall.
Okay.
And I'm going to consider how things are going at the court. I'm going to consider whether or not I think that I have any real use on the court as a peacemaker, as a bridge between both sides. I'm going to look at my physical health, my mental health, and certainly I'm going to look at what my wife thinks I should do. Which is a very important consideration.
Well, congratulations on attaining 77. Is age going to be a big factor, Your Honor?
It will in terms of the physical side of it. I don't think it'll be in terms of the mental side of it. If I felt I was losing it mentally, mm-hmm. That I didn't have any good judicial approaches to cases anymore, I'd get off quickly.
Well, two have already announced for your job. Court of Appeals Judge Joanne Kloppenburg and Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Joseph Donald. And you and I have heard the talk about Milwaukee County Judge, or is she now Court of Appeals Judge, Rebecca Bradley?
Yes, she is. She was just sworn in on the Court of Appeals.
Just sworn in. That's the reason I didn't have it right. You've heard the talk about those three candidates. Does that concern you? Do you think if the conservative and business groups lined up behind Court of Appeals Judge Bradley, and if the liberal moderates lined up behind Judge Kloppenburg, and I don't know Judge Donald very well, that you wouldn't be able to raise enough money to compete with those others if they're backed by big spending third-party groups, Your Honor? Independent groups?
I think you know the old theory that the incumbent starts with a real advantage in terms of name identification, in terms generally of ability to raise dollars, and those would be factors that would certainly weigh in for me. I think all three of them, from everything I know, and I don't know Rebecca Bradley at all. I have spent some time with Joe Donald. He would be a conservative, judicially conservative addition to our court. Joanne Kloppenburg, I think, would be more on the liberal side in terms of philosophy, judicial philosophy. Joe Donald is an interesting candidate because he was appointed by Tommy Thompson. He served on the Wisconsin bench in Milwaukee, the circuit bench, with distinction. He's an African American, which would give some real diversity to our court. I think we've missed the diversity that we had with Justice Lewis Butler. Mm-hmm. And so each one of those three would have some real positives. I wouldn't be surprised if there would be others entering the race as well. So I realize if I'm really going to jump in and do this, I better make my decision and get at it.
As somebody that was unopposed in 2006, are you afraid of having to raise the amounts of money that is now the price of entry into a reelection bid, Your Honor?
That would clearly be a factor.
Are you comfortable raising money, asking people to donate to your campaign?
Well, I think you know that there's been a very recent decision by the United States Supreme Court involving the Florida bar. Mm-hmm. And the rule in Florida was that the candidate cannot ask personally for money.
Thank you for correcting me. You're right. Thank you.
And that's the same rule we have in Wisconsin. You can name a finance committee. You can ask the finance committee to go raise the dollars for you. But you yourself are clearly not to be doing it directly.
Okay.
And yet it's sort of a mixed bag because you can be at your own fundraiser. You can thank people for their donations. You can have your family members work with your finance committee to raise dollars. But the U.S. Supreme Court had some very interesting comments in that Florida bar decision. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the decision, and he started out very early on by saying the judges are not politicians. And he then quoted at length from a speech given by John Marshall back in 1830, talking about how judges have to be independent, how they have to be basically people that the citizens will have faith in, and that independence is extremely important. I thought it was an excellent opinion. And Chief Justice Roberts was very concerned with corruption, and not only actual corruption, but the appearance of corruption in allowing a candidate for judge to go out and ask for dollars.
As you consider whether to seek re-election, have you identified a potential number that you think you'd have to raise? 800,000, a million, and 1.5 million? Any number jump to mind, Your Honor?
No.
Okay.
I know that Chief Justice Abramson, who ran as the Chief Justice at the time, was certainly concerned with raising somewhere around $1 million. I have not looked at what Ann Bradley raised in this last election, so I don't know how that fit, but my impression is she didn't raise nearly as much as Shirley Abramson raised in her last election.
Well, we're almost out of time, so maybe a final question is, when the court term ended yesterday, do you think from a personal relationship and a collegiality standpoint the court had hit bottom, and did you see signs that you were building back up in terms of collegiality and regaining the esteem that our court had 10, 20 years ago? So were you optimistic as the court adjourned its term yesterday, or you still have major concerns, sir?
No, I'm optimistic. I think that we finished our work before midnight. We actually finished somewhere in the range of 7:30, quarter to 8. Overall, it was a good last day on the court. I think we're all adjusting to the changes. And I would give everybody an A for patience yesterday.
Okay.
So I think we're headed in the right direction.
And that your primary, as you sort out whether to seek re-election, your chief criteria will be, can I be a continued peacemaker?
That'll be a major part of it, or whether or not I'm really needed to fill that role. If things are rolling along smoothly, mm-hmm. And people are really getting along and emphasizing some of the things that I mentioned, like the independence of the court, the nonpartisan nature of the court, and looking at whether or not we should join the 48 other states and the feds with an objective recusal standard.
Mm-hmm.
If things were heading in that direction, I would see that I wasn't as needed as otherwise I might feel I was needed to do and to push issues.
Justice Pat Crooks, thank you so much for coming in on the day after the term ends. Congratulations on 19 years on our bench, Your Honor.
Well, thank you, Steve, and thank you for your very good questions.
Okay, thank you.